Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. My name is Paul Taylor, and I am the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. And tonight, we will all have a chance to participate in a remarkable cultural phenomenon. I'm really excited, having listened to the first two calls in this series and watching the groundswell of interest in the conversation that Terry has convened here. It really seems that we are at an important moment in leading-edge culture, and that this call today can be part of something that's making a real difference in the evolution of culture and consciousness all around us. The momentum of interest in this teleseries just continues to build. It's really exciting watching it take part, and we're already a small town, and we're getting larger each and every day. Many of you have asked how you can connect with each other personally to explore the ideas and the inspirations that are arising out of the series. And the first way is our blog, beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, which many of you have already visited. The conversation that began there will soon be migrating to a brand new community site that will be a richer, more flexible, and thoroughly engaging home that we're all very excited about for online discussions and networking. I'll be announcing more about that when it's live so everyone can visit and dive in. So the other way to engage is by joining our Facebook group. There you can meet other people who share an interest in the evolution of spirituality like we all do and engage in ongoing discussions about all the topics we'll be exploring in this series. So just click on the Facebook link in the email we sent you today, or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. Also, as many of you have asked, we have posted a calendar for the next several weeks of dialogues on both the blog and on the Facebook page. We've received many inquiries about where you can find the audio recordings from previous events, so I just wanted to let you know that there is a link in the email we sent you today to download the first two calls from the series. And so, before we begin, I'd like to introduce you at this time to Integral Spiritual Practice founder Terry Patton, who is the host and visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Terry Patton is a vital leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. Terry speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions on a worldwide basis. Terry is a gifted communicator, community builder, successful entrepreneur, educator, and author of four books, and Terry has worked for over three decades as a philosopher, an activist, a coach, a teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness in practical actions that transform very complex systems. He's also the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry. I'm really excited about tonight's call.
Thanks so much, Paul. And hi, everybody. Thank you to everyone, all the wonderful members of the team who've helped create this unique event, and sponsors who make it possible for us all to be here and to offer this absolutely free. And especially I want to thank all of you who are hearing me right now for showing up with sincerity and authenticity and seriousness. That's what makes this inquiry profound and powerful and relevant. It's all of us doing it. It doesn't happen by itself. It's us here, all hands on deck. So this event is titled Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, because I wanted to convene a conversation about a new emerging evolutionary spirituality and how it can be an essential part of how we are rising to the challenges of our time. I am really excited about this. This is the third session in the series. It's the second of our dialogues. This Thursday, we were all given a panoramic view of the whole inner and outer cosmos by the amazing integral philosopher Ken Wilber. And it's my honor tonight to be hosting someone I think of as one of the best examples of a true Renaissance man in our time. He's an important integral philosopher, a leader and entrepreneur, a lifelong athlete, one of the most important founding fathers of the human potential movement, Michael Murphy. And we're going to have a conversation we're calling Embodying the Divine in Everyday Life. This teleseminar series has convened a conversation about how our spirituality can evolve and help us evolve to create a sustainable human presence on this planet. A lot of us were originally inspired to engage spiritual life by realizing the idea behind this quote that's become kind of almost a commonplace in our culture. It's all, usually attributed to Albert Einstein. We cannot solve our problems with the same consciousness that created them. But, you know, it's time for us to redeem that promise. How does this higher consciousness delivered by contemporary spirituality really pay off? How does it enable us to really do it? Or does it help some of the most sensitive and intelligent among us to go inward instead of outward, instead of leaning into changing the world? When I introduced the series last Sunday, I put forward the idea that there's a great evolutionary synthesis going on in human knowledge, in which those of us who are able to see the big picture, who are able to synthesize all of the advances in human knowledge, are seeing evolution as the through line in pretty much everything that has ever been understood by human beings, and that this synthesis changes everything, and especially taken together with our current world crises, it recontextualizes even our spirituality, even our relationship to God and to our own hearts and souls. Now, on Thursday, Ken Wilber offered us a very granular look at the stages of human development, how they relate to awakening into higher states of consciousness, and he painted an inspiring vision of how we might be at the dawning of a whole new integral age. Now, if there's someone who's been a clear stand for a dynamic, practical spirituality in life, in the flesh, so that it isn't just a disembodied, otherworldly thing, the guy who's been doing that from day one is Michael Murphy. He was, you know, we call him a founding father of the human potential movement. That has a lot of components. For one thing, when he was still a very young guy in 1962, he co-founded Esalen Institute. And there, for nearly five decades now, he's been right at the epicenter of things we take for granted. For instance, the popular catching on of things like encounter groups and group therapy and sensitivity training and gestalt therapy and transactional, a lot of that came out of Esalen. The early influence of Buddhist and Hindu teachers, that came out of Esalen. In those early days, he was convening some of the leading thinkers of our time, people like Arnold Toynbee and Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts, and just thinkers who were hugely influential in the culture at large. The whole body work and massage, you know, that stuff wasn't happening, and Esalen brought it forth. But Mike was less associated with some of that than he was with, for instance, the study of extraordinary human capacities, which he popularized with this term, the zone. He wrote a book about that idea, the mysticism of transcendent athletes breaking through into another state, another mode of operation, which they do seemingly superhuman things. This is something he studied probably more than anybody else alive. And he's been profiled widely in The New Yorker, featured in magazines and journals worldwide. I remember reading about him when I was in high school, in York Center, Illinois, reading Look magazine and finding out about this amazing place, Esalen. And those articles were written by another remarkable man, George Leonard. George was Mike's longtime dear friend and compadre and another teacher to me and another co-founder, really, of this human potential movement. Together, they created the first systematic integral approach to long-term practice, integral transformative practice. That started about almost two decades ago. My work with Ken Wilber in creating integral life practice really built on that important foundation. And as a part of really learning it, I participated in the original group that was still going on for a couple of years, and that was how I first met Mike and George and began to learn from them. Now, in terms of Mike's influences, before he graduated from Stanford, he spent a couple of years in South India at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, where he really connected with an influence that's been essential to the spiritual and philosophical foundations of everything he's done since. And he remains a very thoughtful scholar of Aurobindo's work. He also has always been a citizen activist, something I admire and appreciate. In the 80s, he helped organize a pioneering Soviet-American exchange program. And in 89, the first visit to the United States by Boris Yeltsin was sponsored by Esalen Institute. He's the author of several important nonfiction books. The Life We Are Given put forth the principles of integral transformative practice. The Future of the Body is a truly stupendous compendium of knowledge about the higher potentials of the human body's capacities. A book called In the Zone about higher athletics, and then a very important reference book, less widely read but often referenced, The Physical and Psychological Effects of Meditation, where he cataloged over 2,500 studies and really brought together the literature on the effects of meditation for the first time. His book, Golf in the Kingdom, he's written four novels, but Golf in the Kingdom is the one to celebrate because not only is it the best-selling of them all, it's been made into a movie which is premiering this fall at the Mill Valley Film Festival, which is very exciting. Now, most personally, I want to just say something about Mike in a more informal way. What I really love about him is that he proves that an awakened consciousness can be eminently sane and substantial and powerful. He's a man's man. And, you know, so many people's minds go wide and their practical moorings get a little loose. But Mike always stays sincere and balanced and humble and careful and rigorous and self-critical and grounded. He's incredibly knowledgeable and passionate and a formidable character. And I always feel like I walk away from a conversation with Mike having benefited in terms of being educated, being reinforced in my sanity, and being inspired all at once. He's really a truly integral human being. And he's still churning out important new stuff. He's just recently been working on an essay I really love called The Emergence of Evolutionary Panentheism. I'm hoping to talk with him a little about that today. So, welcome, Mike. I'm so happy to have you on the program today.
Good to be here, Terry, and congratulations on this form of conversation. I'm quite impressed.
Well, wonderful, Mike. I kind of want to continue some of the conversations we've been having recently, kind of taking off from this essay, because I think it's an excellent one. So I want to give you a chance to kind of share at least the essence of it. You know, what do you mean by evolutionary panentheism?
Well, panentheism, in distinction to pantheism, is the theological term for the doctrine that the divine is both transcendent to and immanent in the universe, and it is represents a major stance that spiritual stance that goes back certainly into the axial age, 2,700 years ago. Now, this vision of things that emerged then came when people did not know about evolution in our modern sense. So putting the evolutionary in is to simply say what is necessarily entailed when you say the divine is immanent as well as transcendent. That is, if it's immanent in this world, and this world is evolving, as we know, then it's necessarily evolutionary. But as a unified theological or philosophical, I prefer to say philosophical, picture of things, evolutionary panentheism, as I'm framing it now, is not really a named lineage. No major historian of ideas or sociologist of knowledge has written a great work framing this emergent worldview. Now, I want to date it to around 1800 and the German idealists Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, who laid out a vision that was essentially panentheistic and rested on the perception of the world's, that is, the whole universe's advance. Now, that emerged before Charles Darwin, before The Origin of Species was published in 1859. But I want to say that, and many people would, I think, agree with this, that as a coherent worldview, evolutionary panentheism started to emerge among the significant opinion elites of Europe and America around 1800. So I'm very interested in how that's developing in the modern world, though I think it's fair to say that taken as a whole, it's developing on the margins of mainstream culture.
So why is it significant if it's still at the margins? How can it perhaps be of significance even though it's at the margins, I guess?
Well, the great breakthroughs have always come on the margins and have developed their own relationship with the center of a given culture. Whichever big breakthrough in human consciousness or culture you want to look at, let's take the Renaissance. Ficino's little academy in Florence that started really in the very late 15th, but in the 16th century, gave birth to all sorts of ideas that found their way later into the European Enlightenment. But it was funded by the Medicis, and it was there on top of a very prosperous Florence in the 15th century when it started. But it was on the margins. The same, we go back even earlier, the birth of the modern university. Founded mainly by clerics who could not explore certain ideas within the hold of the church. So in the 13th century, people like Roger Bacon and the earliest founders of modern sensibility gathered in these emerging universities at what are now Cambridge and Oxford and in Paris and in Bologna. Again, on the margins, away from the Vatican and the Pope and the centers of ecclesiastical power. Now, you can trace this all the way back, that breakthroughs typically occur in small places on the edges of a culture, and then they there's a kind of a selective process by which these worldviews break out. And you said earlier, Terry, the through line, and all these things we're going to talk about right now, is evolution. So these cultural developments on the margins are quite analogous to speciation events in the biological world, where a new species must develop on the margins of its ancestral population. Why? Because if it's in the center, it's going to be absorbed into the common gene pool. So a new species develops out on the edges, and it gets enough traction, and it's selected, it's more adaptive, it finds a niche for itself, and then it can develop sufficiently to, as it were, break away from the ancestral stem, but carry forward the advance of the animal kingdom, or at least one evolutionary offshoot. So cultural developments on the margin, I think, echo the biological way of speciation events on the margins. In any case, that's just the way it works. So when evolutionary panentheism in its development now is, it's not seen in mainstream academia as a big something. It awaits its great historian of ideas or sociologists of knowledge. I think somebody like an Arthur Lovejoy, who, you know, whose book, the Great Chain of Being, describes, in a way, describes the birth of this thing, what he called the temporalization of the Great Chain of Being. But I don't want to wander too far afield here, Terry.
Yeah, well, thank you for presencing that in a basic way, Mike. I think the sense I have is that we're talking now in our larger conversation here about a convergence that we're seeing among people of widely differing spiritual traditions. Some of them are, you know, fully practicing Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus, and others really are arriving at a new kind of spirituality out of a secular humanist stem. And I think we are sensing that that in a new coming together, there are some agreements, and evolution and spirituality are at the center of it, that maybe we're building towards some kind of critical mass. A lot of people are lighting up. Do you think that in the near future we might see this catch fire in a fuller way? And what are your intuitions about the cultural moment we're in now and how this evolutionary panentheistic view, which I guess is really the evolutionary view with the divine at the center of it all, somehow the nature of it all, how that might, what role that might play in this cultural
moment? Well, you know,
moment.
Terry, I've been, I caught fire at Stanford when I was just 19, and that's 60 years ago. And I have been on fire with this essential vision that I was inspired to in large part originally by Sri Aurobindo, but which has developed all the while, and it led me to start Esalen, which gave me a huge window onto the culture to watch the development of this worldview. But I have to say, Terry, in my judgment of this, it has been a very meandering process. There's not as much front and center public discussion of the sorts of issues that you and I are very interested in and which this conversation is attempting to catalyze. There's not as much front and center kind of taste for the big vision, I believe, as there was in the late 50s and 60s when we started Esalen. There were eight people I can count who were at Esalen: Arnold Toynbee, Paul Tillich, and others, who led programs at Esalen, who were on the cover of Time magazine. Now, it's hard for me to think today who would be on the cover of Time magazine. Indeed, Time magazine itself is kind of pushed off to the periphery. You know, they used to every week come out with a Man of the Week. Well, it'd be very hard to get away with that today. But going back into the early 60s, these characters were appearing on the cover of Time magazine. They were coming to Esalen, but it would be very hard today to even think of people who are capturing the worldwide attention that Arnold Toynbee and Paul Tillich and others were capturing in those days, Martin Buber, as great, widely admired, synoptic visionary thinkers who essentially held some form of evolutionary panentheism. But today, what has intervened is first the great advent in modern philosophy of analytic philosophy and the coup d'etat that swept through the universities of certainly Great Britain and America in philosophy, that was out of positivism and said that the main way of knowing is given to us by the natural sciences. And then in the wake of this movement came what we think of today as French theory, postmodern analysis, Foucault and Derrida and Lyotard, who gave us a lot, who told us a lot about the sociology of ideas, how behind all truth claims there was a potential for a power grab. And this swept through, again, the humanities in America, and you know, hundreds of thousands of kids imbibed all that, and then a kind of allergy to grand meta-narratives broke out, so it was very hard to do the big vision kind of thing. And so the kind of thinking, the synoptic overview thinking, the big vision that we used to think about, represented by a Paul Tillich or a Martin Buber or an Arnold Toynbee or an Aldous Huxley or even to some extent by psychologists like Abraham Maslow in those days in the early 60s, all of that went out of fashion. And then in the vacuum, a kind of tsunami of fundamentalisms has swept through the world, whether Christian or Muslim or Jewish fundamentalisms of various kind, and we see them at work today around the world, causing this Sturm und Drang and all the upheavals in the Middle East and so forth. So this has been a long, slow, meandering birth of a vision from where I sit, Terry. But nevertheless, it keeps coming. And as I see it, I think of it sometimes as kind of appearing out of the mist, you know, and then disappearing again into the mist and then coming forward. Now, you take Ken Wilber's work. Ken is, there's no one who more represents this big vision than Ken Wilber. And yet his vision for a lot of people has come in and out of focus in the academic world. Now, for thousands of us who admire and respect his work and have deep allegiance to it and are, you know, are part of the same developing culture, for us, he is front and center. But for an awful lot of people out there, they're distracted by these other movements. So that's from where I sit, Terry. We have to face the fact that this thing is still emerging out of the mist and vanishing again as if to Brigadoon, and then it reappears again. It's looking for its public voices. I feel it's awaiting a great synoptic work that could capture the imagination of our opinion elites in the way, say, Burry's Big Idea of Progress, his book, or Collingwood's The Idea of History, or Arthur Lovejoy's The Great Chain of Being.
So I think that's the thing.
But now, meanwhile, though, Terry, the elements of practice have flooded the land. And Esalen's been in the middle of that, and I've watched that. So the elements have practiced, in my judgment, have emerged to a greater extent than the elements of the overarching worldview or meta-narrative. In other words, it's interesting. Practice seems to be ahead a vision when it comes to the culture at large. It's very interesting. Well, when I was a kid and grew up in Salinas, California, and at Stanford, got fired up by Sri Aurobindo and told my family that I was going to go to India. My father said, "Well, son, you don't need to come back here anymore. I just hope you don't end up like Om the Omnipotent." He was an Indian guru who was said to have a hippopotamus in his swimming pool and invited all the ladies upstairs for an initiation one-on-one. He was a tantric guru. This is way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And so my father in Salinas, California, believe me, there were no centers of yoga. Today, you go to Salinas, you know, John Steinbeck wrote about Salinas, and those who are listening in might know about Salinas. Well, now, there are yoga classes all over the place. You can go to Topeka, Kansas, all across the Midwest. There are practices of all kinds, out of the martial arts, out of the yogas, out of the rediscoveries of Christian mysticism and Jewish mysticism are spreading. Rumi has become probably the most widely read poet in the world today.
In America, I think he is, yeah.
Yeah, I think worldwide right now there have been some articles about this, but you know the kind of mystical practice represented by Rumi in the country he was born, Afghanistan, or in Iran, where he, you know, the greater Iran, and when he died in Turkey.
Yes.
Now, now, you know, you can't practice that kind of Sufism. The again, practice is outrunning the unified philosophic vision, and I think that's something interesting we might talk about.
Well, it really feeds right into Ken's idea of a post-metaphysical approach to spirituality that underlies our approach to integral life practice, which builds on the integral transformative practice that you originated with George Leonard. The fundamental idea there being, well, debate about it all you want. If you do this, if you perform this injunction, and you do it with enough consistency over enough time, and you really conform yourself to the nature of the injunction with sincerity and depth and persistence and with guidance and repetition, you will see the result. You will experience a transformative effect. And in a way, the practice move does obviate the philosophical deadlock, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. When it comes to the great transformative practices that have come to birth in the human race, and I would take it way back to you know, the 3,000 years anyway, that the Upanishads, let's say, give voice to, and many other traditions. I mean, you can find in Taoism, and then the whole emergence of Buddhist practice, and more and more we're seeing the discovery now of esoteric practices in the Greek and the Hellenic world that led up to Plato and then into Neoplatonism. If you look at of all of that, the philosophic support you can characterize as minimalist. In the Upanishads, it was a stripped down metaphysics. Now, you can, William James called the unwarranted truth claims that cluster around particular practices over beliefs. You know, we have an epiphany with a certain teacher, or we have a conversion experience at a Christian revival meeting, or we get in with a guru who's come up with some new slant on things. We have an experience, and then we buy in to the whole metaphysics that we get with that teacher or that cult. And a lot of it is unnecessary. I think what the world is getting vaccinated against these unwarranted truth claims. I personally believe, Terry, there are some millions of people out there now who have had enough immersion in true practice and have been wounded enough by, you know, destructive cults and lame gurus and wildly contradictory claims about this, that, and the other thing by a variety of teachers, that they've gotten vaccinated against the whole panoply of overloaded metaphysics and truth claims. And so it's a culture developing, I think, that's becoming more and more battle-tested. We miss, okay, I think...
Not just cynical, then, just battle-tested, and maybe therefore wiser.
Well, I think, yes, I think there's the spread of a more settled wisdom. Now, with our, in America, this profoundly extroverted culture, now reinforced by email and Facebook and Twitter and hundreds of television channels and just an explosion of books and media. So everything has kind of gotten so extroverted that it's harder and harder to mount the long-term practices that would produce a great sage like Ramana Maharshi or someone like Sri Aurobindo or someone like Ramakrishna. That is not happening. There isn't the depth of practice prevalent in the modern world today. But there is, I believe, a huge cohort of us who are dedicated to practice and who have been, who are battle weary in the paradigm wars between this guru and that guru and the other guru.
Right.
And who we have almost like in our world, our own Tea Party movement says enough of these. Enough of all this. Enough.
Enough. Enough.
Enough.
But not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, obviously. Yeah, there's a kind of purity of aspiration that survives all of that disappointment.
Well, I believe so. And we see that, of course, at Esalen, about 10,000 people a year come through there. So about 300,000 have come through. Probably about 200,000 different people have come through in the 48 years of our programs. So I know at first hand how alive this culture is, and people that come through Esalen come from all around the world. Actually, Terry, you know, we've kept track, have come from more than 100 countries, and because we've been keeping track of this. So it's a worldwide movement. I mean, you'd be surprised, these groups in Cairo and in Tel Aviv and people, of course, large cohorts from Japan and now from China, mainland China, and, of course, from all over Europe. And so this is all around the world. This savoir-faire, you know, this this kind of a preliminary enlightenment, let me call it this, this first landing on the, you know, on the beaches of metaphysical Normandy, of this tremendous army of explorers. I'm tumbling metaphors here, but this is at work. But what I miss, and I think what is coming, is a dawning of a more philosophic voices that are widely respected, you see.
Right.
Ken Wilber has given us a magnificent epistemology in this Aqual, you know, all levels, all lines framework that he's developed. Any big narratives that are going to be written out about the emergence of this thing are going to have to embrace the various dimensions of existence that he talks about there. But that's yet to appear, as far as I'm concerned, in the wide world.
I find myself wondering whether the global challenges that we face, the problems that require humanity to recognize that we're all in this, you know, we're all on spaceship Earth together. We all need one another. We have no way of making sense of the kinds of responses we need to make except big picture ways of knitting together our parochial stories. Won't that mitigate toward a more synthetic view so that generalists will try to reunite the fragmented views of all the specialists and try to make a more essential sense? And doesn't this evolutionary panentheist or integral view kind of, it sits here right at the center of things, offering a much more adequate explanation, not just for how we might cooperate, but why we want to, and why we want not only to make a contribution, but to actualize our own potentials. You know, why, you know, in some sense, it connects us to the very, you know, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower, the essential spirit of evolution.
Well, again, I mean, there's a drive in all of us for unity with our fellows, and for conceptual unity, but there's also the drive for freedom, and there is the wounds we've all suffered from premature attempts at unity that constrict the human spirit. I mean, most of us have been born to some form or another of a, let's call it a religious worldview, whether we were born Jewish or Christian or Muslim or whatever. Even in secular households, my my family was largely secular, although I cottoned on to the Episcopal Church and became a choir boy. I was the only church boy, churchgoer in my family. But in our family, there was certainly a lot of coherent worldview, and in all of our families. So let me put it this way. We all have come up through some sort of worldview or several worldviews. It's a requirement of consciousness to have some sort of coherence, however naive, however primitive it may be, in how we look at the world. There are different degrees of, let's call it worldview literacy, self-conscious we are, how cultivated we are in our relation to how we see the world as a whole. In other words, that's operative in us all, but this fragmenting tendency, which is also an opening up tendency, it's with freedom can come fragmentation. So these two drives, to unity and freedom, Teilhard de Chardin said, the greatest conflict in human nature is between love and freedom. You can call love carries with it this drive to unity with everyone and everything. So this is at play right now in all of us. And when you look at the opinion elites, when you look at the at those who command huge followings, whether they're voices in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, or on television, or in positions of political power, or in the ruling elites of the various religious traditions. These different elites are at odds in the universities. You know, there's a profound secular and materialist reductionism there. Profound. And so all of this is in play at once. And what I see is through it all, you use this line, evolution is a through line. The through line I find more in the elements of practice that are spreading all over the place. I mean, more and more people practicing meditation in some form or other, or some form of mindfulness practice. I've watched it emerge, Terry, as you know, and as you said so generously, in the world of sport. You know, I wrote this book, Golf in the Kingdom. It was published 40 years ago, and in those days, I don't think there were many golf pros who had sports psychologists or the inner game gurus. Now,
and now it's commonplace, isn't it?
It's commonplace. And and everywhere you go, I mean, certainly in medicine, alternative and complementary medicine has exploded across the wide world and much more prevalent today than it was 40 years ago. So you find these influences in many, many fields and spreading all the while. So it's as if the table's being set for more coherent vision. But we got a lot of work to do on that front.
Now, thank you so much. That was really a very clear-eyed summary. I think I want to circle around to this because I think many of us hold dear the sense that, you know, we're in a crisis time and in some way we need to rise to it, and that our practice and our spirituality, the fundamental inspiration and directionality, that which uplifts our spirit, is essentially requiring us to make a contribution for the good of all in some way. And having a positive and hopeful vision is important to us.
Yes.
But perhaps what's clearest to us, and clearest not just in our minds, but almost clearest to our instinctual being, you know, our embodied knowing, is the matter of practice, of self-cultivation, of growing and realizing our inbuilt potentials, and discovering that there's something transcendent and even sacred in the in the body mind itself, and right. that intuition seems to be rising like the sap from below, not just the branches, the light from above,
yes.
but coming up from our very roots.
Right. Well, that I agree totally, Terry. I mean, we those of us involved in this conversation right now share that a rising sap, as you put it, that aspiration. And that aspiration calls for some kind of unifying vision. Now, the vision we hold, the philosophy we hold, is going to shape our practice. Now, this is where I come back to this evolutionary panentheism. Many of the practices that have emerged come out of otherworldly orientation, many of them Buddhist or Hindu, that say the aim of the practice is to release us from samsara, from this veil of tears, from this place of constant suffering, into nirvana, into moksha. And therefore, pull us toward a subtle or not so subtle asceticism, away from embodied life. Now, when you go to a panentheistic vision that says the world, that the divine is immanent, that everything is secretly divine, that has a different orienting power and leads us to see the whole wide world is shot through with divinity, and that the elements of our common life are filled with the seeds of practice. Jeff Kripal, who has written this huge, beautiful history of Esalen Institute, has called this turn the tantric turn, and he has proposed that a great inflection occurred in the Western world in mid 20th century from the otherworldly orientations that were coming in from Buddhist and Hindu sources mainly, but were led by the Vedanta Society, say, and some of the more ascetic forms of Theravada Buddhism. And but the inflection occurred to this tantric idea that through the embrace of the common life and the cultivation of the tendencies that emerge in the practices of everyday life, for example, sport, these can be leveraged to open us up to the higher splendors and knowings and illuminations and powers and so forth. Although Dick Price and I, when we started Esalen, didn't see ourselves as part of this inflection, I mean, it was happening all around us. That is the case. So, for example, when I wrote my first book, Golf in the Kingdoms, about golf, I mean, you know, if you can see golf as a tantric practice in the sense that you play this game, and I've discovered this through, I don't know, thousands of reports, Terry, over the last 40 years since I wrote that book, of people who have quasi-mystical experiences and occult experiences on golf courses. I've collected literally now, truly, thousands of such reports for 40 years from sports people. Now, in other words, this is a tantric practice. In other words, the idea being that a game as absurd as golf somehow picks up on these elements of our nature when people play wholeheartedly, you know.
These extraordinary capacities, and also when you say tantric, you're talking about uniting or bringing together the transcendent and the
yeah.
physical.
Somehow, when we aspire to some sort of perfection, whether it's artistic or athletic or in a relationship, it enlists the deep self, and it can then be cultivated and lead us into greater consciousness. The problem is that with most of these practices, people who stumble into them don't have a guiding philosophy that's adequate to the unfolding experience. But once you get this philosophy, as some of these athletes are doing today, or and many artists and people in all sorts of activities, when they come to a, let's call it, some form of a evolutionary panentheistic view, Aurobindonian view, tantric view, if they come to that view, then this activity that they love becomes, in effect, a transformative practice. Now, I've seen this again and again and again. Now, that, I think, also is kind of catching on. People are beginning to embrace a worldview that says the world indeed is going somewhere, and that you and I and all of us are part of this divine unfoldment. Not to get out of the world, but to transform the world, to bring the divine life into higher definition, into prominence. And, of course, as you know, that I've pushed this in some other novels as a thought experiment, that the flesh itself is participating always, to some degree, as you practice. Doesn't matter, even in the otherworldly practices, the flesh is participating. You cannot escape the integral. We're always body-mind. It's inescapable. But you might as well join it fully, because then you have a better chance to enlist what really wants to happen here, namely to bring the divine forth in the on the earth plane and in the flesh itself. This worldview, which is implicit, I think, will inevitably win out because it's what the world most deeply wants. It is our deepest predisposition. And the ascetic impulse, which is very, very important for many of us, I think most of us at some period in our life, to shape up our practice, is not the whole story and not the final end. Anyway.
That's beautiful. What an eloquent celebration and advocacy for an incarnated spirituality. I think I'd like to press into this a little further. You're not making that point. You wouldn't be making that point with such passion if it was a straw man, if the otherworldly spirituality were only a thing of the past. So I think implicit in what you just said is that there might be other people, maybe even people I'll be talking with on this series, who in some way, from your point of view, are a little otherworldly, and I'm not so much trying to create controversy or ask you to name names, but what are the points of view that seem like they're still in the struggle here that don't fully get this point?
All right, I'll give you some examples. First of all, there are many wonderful teachers who are in deep allegiance to, say, classical Vedantic teaching or Theravada teaching, and who are giving the modern world tremendous lessons about meditation and about the kinds of yogas that deliver these illuminations. We have to learn from that. We have to incorporate what they bring us into this more integral, comprehensive practice. But very often in these groups, they will denigrate the siddhis. That's the Hindu, the Sanskrit word for the supernormal powers or illuminations that occur in the practice of yoga.
Which might now include something like ESP or
there are literally hundreds of these things. The more I get into it, I realize, I mean, there's certainly hundreds of named siddhis in the Hindu-Buddhist traditions. But the famous saying, moksha, liberation, before siddhi. And very often, the teacher will say, reject these siddhis. What you want is moksha. Now, the Sri Aurobindo took the opposite point of view, and the way I like to see it is that these capacities as they emerge are the budding limbs and organs of our latent supernature. These are the harbingers of what we will become. For example, these, you know, in my book, The Future of the Body, anybody can see it there. I've got in there descriptions of hundreds of these siddhis, and I argue that every human capacity, which we that every one of us has, you know, perception, cognition, for volition, etc., all of them, which have been inherited, by the way, from our animal ancestors, all of them give rise to supernormal expressions, siddhis, or in the Catholic Church, they're called charisms. In shamanism, they were the shamanic powers. In Sufism, these are the adornments of the man of light. They're there in every great religious tradition, these supernormal powers. If you see them as part of our emerging supernature, an integral practice is necessarily entailed. In other words, you have to, if you see them as part of the divine emergence, you want to embrace them, and this can empower practice. Yes, you can get infatuated with this or that power, and some of these gurus are right to say, don't get carried away by your new ESP powers or your whatever. Sure, you need a balanced practice. That's another question. But that's one of the great tells, one of the great markers between the ascetic worldview, the otherworldly worldview, the world transcending views, and the earth embracing the incarnational views, which map more squarely onto what is really up here in the universe. Because if you believe, as I do and many of us do, that all this cosmos is in a progressive manifestation of the divine. That's the basic idea of evolutionary panentheism. It's all the progressive manifestation. Schelling said that it's all the Deus implicitus becoming the Deus explicitus.
That's such a beautiful phrasing, yes.
Aurobindo said, apparent nature is secret God. It's all trying to give birth. We're all in this long, slow, often meandering, often monstrous disclosure of the divine. But to the extent that we can pick up on this and we can nurture what really wants to happen and really get behind it, then these budding powers, these siddhis, these charisms, these supernormal powers, we can embrace and welcome and nurture and cultivate, and we become more ourselves. It's to adopt many of these more otherworldly practices, it's like if you were going to play golf and have to wear a very tight girdle, you know, a corset. It's like putting, you know, shackling yourself unnecessarily.
Uh-huh.
You're
it's an overly rigid interpretation of the perception that these... Yes, the siddhis might be secondary to moksha, but there's no reason to suppress them before moksha. Your point?
Well, right. What I think we have to really factor in more and more is the fact that each of us is unique, and this is central, of course, to the integral transformative practice that I started with George Leonard. That every practice to a large extent is tailor-made. You know, when I was a kid, my father always took us down to the tailor to have our suits made. I was, you know, lucky that way. But, you know, nowadays people just go somewhere and you just buy one off the rack. But we have to tailor-make our practices to our unique makeup. Yes, we share common... We share attributes with everybody, and there are certain things that hold true for virtually all of us, certain maxims of practice. But you have to tailor-make it, and it's in large part because each of us has a different superconscious profile, and that starts to emerge when you start to practice. Every human has a different face. We all have different fingerprints. Every voice print is different. We can't escape our uniqueness just as we can't escape our universality. The ultimate unity overcomes our separateness, but it doesn't overcome our uniqueness. Uniqueness
right.
is different than separateness.
Exactly.
In other words, it's, and this was Sri Aurobindo, that part of the cosmic play, the divine, the cosmic advance, is an evolution of souls, a plurality of souls. I often like to say that you can think of the divine as a many, as well as a one. It's both, of course, because if the souls are rooted in the divine, and if they carry some profound uniqueness, if this is the nature of things, then it certainly has to be respected here. And, of course, you need a culture that's elastic enough. This is why we needed constitutional democracy. This is why America and Europe have given us structures that facilitate the growth of the individual. There are the excesses of individualism, but that elasticity which is missing in other cultures. For example, let's take the Sharia, what the Taliban want. And if women don't behave, they cut off their noses. They stone people for to death, stone these women to death for adultery. These cultures who have not gone through the kind of development we have in the West to allow this elasticity of personal development, won't allow this sort of thing. And then even within our, here in the United States and in Europe, we still have these awful rigidities that have to be overcome. That's still a work in progress. And, you know, Ken Wilber's beautifully described that we have so many levels of development going on at once in this vast, amazing world of ours that we have to negotiate these differences. But that principle of uniqueness and all, I think, has to be put front and center in an integral practice if we're going to embody the divine and if we're going to give expression to our latent supernature.
And there's just one thing I want to ask you about that. This is lovely. So this uniqueness might express itself in unique, extraordinary capacities that might come online. And our incarnational spirituality expresses itself in embracing the capacities that might spontaneously awaken rather than suppressing them. But it would also express itself in a tremendous commitment to this world. And, you know, one of the things I emphasize is like a sense of planetary citizenship and civic responsibility and the sense that that we're emerging from a period in which social commitment only knew how to express itself through progressive politics, and that something that transcends and includes that, that's more transpartisan and that's more deeply spiritually inspired, might be ready to come online. I wonder if you see that connecting directly in just the way we were talking about.
Absolutely. The what I think of as the integral necessarily includes the political world and environmentalism and sustainability. This is the whole earth. I mean, we are here to shepherd the whole earth into its greater glories, and we've got to take care of the earth, and we've certainly got to find a more effective political discourse. It's one thing to have differences expressed in political parties. It's another thing to have this awful kinds of impasse and bickering we've got going on in Washington right now. So a lot of us are working in the political sphere at Esalen. We're doing a lot in the citizen diplomacy, and we, you know, have made quite a commitment to bonding with Russia, and we're starting that initiative again, because Russia and America have drifted apart over this last 8 or 10 years. Here we are ending the Cold War without annihilating one another, but it's tragic that we've drifted apart. But in any case, all of these activities, yes, Terry, absolutely, you're right, are entailed. Once you say that the Earth is the scene of the great divine adventure, that, I think, tends to pull us more into social action than if we say it's just essentially a hellhole to be transcended. Now, you know, people respond to me in this and say, well, what about the Bodhisattva ideal? I say, well, that is one of the glorious avatars, the idea of the Bodhisattva. But I think the whole idea of service to the world is more powerfully reinforced by a panentheistic view than it is a transcending worldview, a strictly theistic point of view. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because it's organic and natural and not built on dualisms and separation, subtle dualisms behind the apparent non-dualism.
Well, yeah. It has a lot of what William James called a lot of cash value, you know, the pragmatic test of a philosophy. First of all, it tends to orient you much more to social action, this kind of worldview. And secondly, it's more alert to the ways and means of transformation, you know, these supernormal expressions, these siddhis. I think what we're in a process right now, I and some friends are trying to do this, is to name some new siddhis, you know. And, for example, the varieties of empathy. There are different kinds of fellow feeling and sympathy and empathy.
Certain people
are really good at tuning in to your suffering.
Yeah.
Other people are very, very good at tuning in to talents. Working with coaches, I'm just blown away at times, Terry, by how these coaches can look at a person. I had my running coach, Mike Spino, and we were all running. This is back in the 70s and 80s. He could predict what each of us was going to run the next, you know, we were, you know, trying to improve our mile time. And he could predict it right down to within 2 or 3 seconds. It was uncanny. And
wow.
Then he could predict, and I got to know Bill Walsh, who built up this great 49ers dynasty in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, he'd take one glance at somebody and say all sorts of things about their abilities that I had no way of seeing. I mean, how he saw it, I don't know. But this is partly acquired through his long-standing interest, but partly probably a gift he had. So it got me thinking of the different siddhis of empathy. It isn't just empathy. What kinds of empathy?
Yeah.
Great politicians. I really do think that Bill Clinton has filled with these kinds of abilities. I watched him today on Meet the Press, and he, you know, in spite of all his peccadilloes and stuff when he was president, you know, I think history will show his ranking is going to go up. And he certainly is a gifted politician, and he has an enormous ability to tune into people. So it was long said, you know, for example, in the Catholic charisms, the secret of reading hearts, that you can read people and find their deepest impulses. And of course, the greatest teachers probably have had that gift. So in other words, the siddhis of world manifestation, many of them are yet to be named, because I think transcending the world was always privileged in the great contemplative traditions, East and West. And because the otherworldly power, let's say siddhis, were tended to be privileged, the siddhis of the common life were not. And those are yet to be named. I think that's going to happen more and more as time goes on.
And maybe some of those capacities will prove instrumental aspects of how humanity musters a healthy adaptive response to the crises of our time.
Yes, I think that's very, very true.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Mike. I feel like I could go on with you all day, but I've already gone a little later than I had intended for this part of our conversation, and I'm sure there are many people listening in right now who'd like to join the conversation. So if you're listening via the web, you can go ahead and type out a concise question in the Instant Teleseminar window starting now. But before we begin to answer the questions, I have a few things I'd like to let everybody know about. First, I'd like to thank the presenters of this series, Integral Spiritual Practice and Evolving Wisdom. Beyond Awakening is also being made possible and is presented free of charge by the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including tonight, Integral Transformative Practice International, the organization that grew organically out of Michael Murphy and George Leonard's 1992-1993 experiment in creating an integral practice community. They support people from all over the world to support one another in engaging a long-term program for realizing the potential of body, mind, heart, and soul. For more information, visit itp-international.org. That's itp-international.org. Our sisters in evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. Find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at femininepower.com. It's titled The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine. That's online at femininepower.com. And also by our friends at Our Future Planet. Our Future Planet is a charitable online network that allows you to share ideas, design your future, and create global change in the real world. By joining Our Future Planet, you can understand how global issues are linked, design a positive vision for the future, and create solutions to get us there, connect with others with mutual interests and ideas, bring your ideas to life through actions and projects. Join this community of planetary citizens, people who care about the future of our planet and who wish to contribute to positive changes by going to ourfutureplanet.org. And finally, this Thursday at this same time, please be sure to tune in to the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen, author of many books and the founder of the award-winning Enlightened Next magazine. And he's really one of the clarion voices who's been articulating and very intensely driving the intensity of an understanding of an evolutionary approach to spirituality. So he'll be speaking with me about the practice of evolution. So let's get into the question and answer section of this evening with Mike Murphy. And if you have a question and you're on the phone line and you're in the Eastern time zone, you're invited to raise your hand by pressing *2. But I'm going to turn first to the web. Let's see. Emily in New York City asks, I know you mentioned that practice is tailor-made, but in your experience, are there practices or a combination of practices that seem to work exceptionally well across the board?
That's for me, Terry?
Yes, it is.
Well, I said that they can be tailor-made. In other words, I think the very best teachers always have guided their students in accordance with their intrinsic nature. But yes, there are certain primal practices that work for virtually everyone. For example, meditation. In the classical Eastern sense, whether expressed in Theravada Buddhism as Vipassana or in Zen, basic Zazen practice or in the Samkhya philosophy, distinguishing Purusha from Prakriti, all the ones in which you simply learn that you are not your thoughts. You have thoughts, but you can sit back from your thoughts, watch them pass, let them go, and even nip them in the bud, and thus allow a deeper witnessing consciousness to emerge that can morph into that being which is described as Atman in Vedanta, Atman, which is Brahman. So the simple act of meditation is, I think, universal. There's a lot of evidence that the higher mammals, you can watch a cat sitting, a big cat, tiger, or a little cat, or a dog. And perhaps you have a pet, a dog, who points when you meditate and puts his paw up on your shoulder. My wife Dulcie had a dog, Bo, who would sometime become profoundly entrained with her meditation. And once when she was in a deep state and was moved and some tears came to her eyes, opened them, and there was Bo with his paw on her shoulder, and he seemed to be kind of sorrowful, not sorrowful, a deep joy with her. In other words, this is a, I would say, a universal primal act that much neglected in contemporary culture, which is so profoundly extroverted, meditation. So that that is universal. The same with prayer, a reaching out to the to a divine that is beyond our present self. We all know how to pray. I would argue we all know something about meditation, even if we've never practiced it. But when we go to a meditation class and we can learn to sit still for a few minutes and learn to just observe our thoughts, we can catch on fairly fast. So yes, there are these and other universally applicable practices that come up naturally in human nature. And I believe that many of them are happening all the time. I think an awful lot of people find their way to meditation, you know, washing dishes or even bowling. It's the only way I can really understand the fascination with bowling. But
it's a meditative sport by its nature, you think.
Repeating this sport to understand golf, this incredible power that golf has to induce these experiences. We tap into these primal acts. So, yeah. My answer to her is absolutely.
So there are some
practices. Yeah.
Right, but I'd like to push into that a little bit with you, Mike, in the sense that one of the things you've asserted and that I assert too with Ken and Integral Life Practice is that one of the things that we know as a universal is that integrating practices of body, mind, heart, and soul, spirit, and relationship is really important, that there's a principle of cross-training and that we grow a lot faster if we don't only meditate.
That's correct. The evidence now, Terry, is overwhelming that physical fitness helps meditation. There have been, well, dozens of good studies. Steve Donovan and I put together the biggest catalog of scholarly or scientific meditation studies many years ago. Then it was about 2,200. The Institute of Noetic Sciences has updated it three times. There are now more than 3,000 studies that have been reported out in respectable scholarly or scientific journals. And some of these studies have embraced both fitness training and meditation and provide strong evidence. I mean, we know it already intuitively. We know it from the emphasis many of the old yoga schools put on hatha yoga in conjunction with meditation practice, asanas, you know, Patanjali sutras, the greatest sutras in the Hindu traditions, you know, describe these sorts of postures and breathing exercises.
It's an inherently integral description, isn't it?
Yes.
Patanjali
sutras,
yes.
If you look at the greatest systems, at the very least, they're embryonically integral, and some of them very explicit about it. But yes, the synergies of that are provided in an integral framework give it a great advantage. Some of the critics I've had, Future of the Body, you know, that it's too ambitious, that who can possibly embrace all these things? And Ken, Wilbur and I have discussed this critique, and he's made the point often to me that the integral is the short way home. It's contrary to those who say it's too complicated. No, if you embrace the different parts of your being, you get tremendous synergies out of this. I mean, you may various kinds of what we would think of as therapeutic moves, you know, to address our what's in the darkness of our natures, our shadow, to look at our various hang-ups. We get a lot of help from modern Freudian and post-Freudian and dynamic psychiatry. We get all sorts of guidance that actually did not exist to this degree and with this sophistication in many of the yoga systems. The modern West has given us some new practices that complement what we get from the East. The synergies of integral practice is a great boon.
Yeah, good. I so agree, and it feels even that something is coming together, even in the intersubjective with the community dimension of practice as well.
Well, communities, small communities of practice are so helpful. It's like singing in the shower. I mean, there's more resonance when you sit in a group. Now, also, we all need to learn to mindfulness in everyday life when we're not in a group, when we're all alone or at work or out for a walk or whatever we're doing. But nevertheless, to have a community to support us it can be a tremendous help.
Thanks, Mike. I want to offer another question from Darlene in Santa Monica. Thank you, Michael, for creating Esalen. I so love it. Do you believe the emphasis on practice versus philosophy indicates a rise of the feminine? That's kind of one question. But then there's another question she goes on to that I think is quite important. What do you think the impact is of technology and speed on our psyches and physiology? Will the detriment outweigh the benefits of, she says, globalization, but I mean there are many changes right now that we're benefiting from? How do you...
Yeah.
Please comment on the impact of technology and speed.
Well, right now, I've become very aware of the destructive side of this technology and speed. I mean, we are really being made, we're being extroverted and fragmented more and more to the degree that we, you know, how did we ever do it with before emails? I'm constantly had to change my email address because I've gotten into various so-called email groups, where let's say maybe 30 or 40 people are communicating to each other all at once. This can be very useful in inquiries such as we are conducting at Esalen. Let's say you're in four groups and you're getting 200 or 300 emails a day. I can't handle it. For me, I have not learned how to find the silence that I need during the day to some extent with so much. And then when you add Twitter, some people are, you know, reporting in on their bowel movements to countless thousands of others. You know, and there are people who follow this sort of thing. You report in on everything you're doing during the day. I don't see how. I mean, this is going too far. And then channel surfing, you know, people watch television. They'll be going 10 or 20 at once. I have some friends who do love football, and they've got it set up so they can watch all the NFL games at once. They're going on in a display of about 8 or 10 screens as if their home becomes a sports bar. So this technology is, this is a problem, Houston.
Do you think there's any plus side to it? Is this only a negative?
Well, okay, I've heard a number of arguments that young people today are learning to multitask and all of this. Well, I don't know, Terry. I mean, time will tell. Right now, I think we've got a cultural meander. Maybe not all things that develop are necessarily good. I like to say evolution meanders more than it progresses at all levels. I mean, certain species evolve in such a way as to put themselves out of business. Think of the saber-toothed tiger. Certain people that you and I know are evolving all right, but are they evolving in the right direction? And on this one, the jury's out. I think, obviously, the Internet and all of our connectivity gives us a lot, but I'm beginning to think that, you know, in every age, there are certain virtues are overrated and certain others are neglected. Right now, communication is overrated. There's so much communication with so many people at so many levels, whereas silence and the practice of emptiness is underrated. Yes, there are great benefits, but yes, there are great dangers. The practice of emptiness itself, which is part of the royal road to where we want to go, it too can, if it's all you're doing and you're not developing, as you and I just said, our different aspects, our different capacities, these the budding limbs and organs of our emerging nature, that too can become a danger. So it's a two-edged sword, I think, all the speed and the technological development.
And a challenge that we just need to take seriously as a potential source of incoherence in our
system. We have to learn, we have to integrate it in a wise way. And, of course, an awful lot of us are learning how to manage our emails and all of these new means of communication. What she asked about the feminine, I do think that as more and more women have emerged from the stereotype existence that was prevalent in, that was enshrined in earlier cultures, you bring an explosion of human possibility onto the world scene. We need this all over the world. I love it that the Clinton Initiative now is really going after this, to the empowerment of women and young girls and the education worldwide. Now, in the human potential movement, most of the people who've tried to study it find that there are more women engaged in it than men. The numbers vary, but it was the same with the spread of evangelical Christianity in early America, that more women than men were carrying this and helping to civilize these men as they headed west with their revolvers and, you know, to conquer the Wild West. Well, the same, I would say, life-embracing tendency in women. I think women tend toward the tantra more than the men in the sense of the anti-ascetic. That's been my experience at Esalen, that, somatics and body work and the embrace of relationships, the cultivative relationships, is driven to some important extent more by women than by men. So the feminine in that sense is its emergence in our day reflects a filling out of the social potential of a culture. To suppress any group, whether it's ethnic or whether it's an entire gender, is to lose our social potential. When you see this in Afghanistan, the Taliban's repression of women, or in Iran now, it's awful. Anyway.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. I have someone who's raised their hand from the Eastern time zone who has an unlisted number who I'm going to call on. I usually don't, but do you recognize yourself? Please speak up. Hello? Are you there?
Hello.
Well, we can't seem to hear you. Sorry. We've got another caller from outside the country. This is a 523 prefix. Hello?
Yes. Hello. Yes. Hi, Michael and Terry. How are you both?
You're echoing pretty badly. If you'd state your question very concisely, we can maybe hear it before I have to mute you.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I'm wondering about the concise or coherent practice being that of unity consciousness, where social groups or whole collectives, ultimately our entire species, can share a commonly sensed intelligence in a fully embodied way simply by making awareness its own perceptual object, as the mystics have suggested for thousands of years, that essentially awareness...
That's about as much as we can handle of the echo. I hope you got out your main idea. Do you want to comment on that, Mike?
Well, yeah, I think if I'm understanding him, this is awareness in its most fundamental sense. Our shared awareness, if it goes deep enough, it's the kind of awareness that is cultivated in the great Eastern meditation traditions, that to the degree that that is cultivated by more and more people, the world's going to be on a happier path. Absolutely. I think that every incarnational practice must embrace that which is beyond incarnation. It seems paradoxical, but what is called the mindfulness, we can stretch this metaphysically, the Buddhists call shunyam, emptiness, samkhya-vasi, purusha. We can begin by understanding that as the witness self, that which remains after we drop this thought, But here we are. It outlasts every thought. It never goes away. This, finally, Atman, from the Sanskrit, itself, the ultimate I, the I beyond all our little eyes, the I beyond the ego, that kind of primal awareness, as that dawns in the human race, that is the basis of our eternal unity. And I think as we tune into that together, yes, it can become a powerfully binding social force. I think that's what he was getting at there.
Yes, and that we might even do shared intentional experiments of resting in that root of awareness and in some ways magnify the force of that primordial consciousness as it is all in all, doesn't it? It can't be deleted or magnified, but our experience of it and the kind of the field effect is perhaps part of what he's getting at.
Well, we've an awful lot of us have done this in small groups, and we can do this in larger groups. And Yes.
Well, thank you, Mike. We're a little over our time. Do you think you can hang on with us long enough to take another question?
Okay. One more question, Terry, and then I have to go on to something else here.
Sure. I thank you. We have a caller from Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
What's your name?
My name is Judith, and
welcome.
I was very intrigued by the use of the word panentheistic. I wasn't aware of that, and I looked it up, and it's the belief or doctrine that God is greater than the universe and includes and interpenetrates it. And I'm wondering if that relates to the idea, or God relates to the idea of the first cause, and are we not co-creators as we evolve? I had some very amazing experiences for about 2 weeks long with the opening of the third eye. That I mean, it truly felt that way. And that was one of the things. I went, oh, my gosh, nobody's in charge now. It's up to all of us to keep evolving. And all the people that have come before. Anyway, I would appreciate your commenting on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith.
Judith, I love that statement of yours. And that was a profound realization you had there. And I agree. It's up to all of us. I personally believe, Judith, that all of us are rooted in the divine, and part of this amazing, mysterious world we have is that we have fallen away, most of us, to a large extent from that primal station in the divine, so we can return to it in meditation, and graces are given to us where we glimpse it again, but we have to grow into it, and the more that we all can do it together, the better it will be for this world of ours.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining us all for this broadcast, Mike. I know that I speak for everyone when I thank you and praise you. You know, that there's an eloquence and a passion and a vivacity and a freshness in your expression. I want to be like you when I grow up.
Well, Terry, listen, congratulations on this brave venture of yours. You're forming a new community here, and it may give birth to some wondrous, wondrous things. So thank you very much, Terry, and congratulations on this, and good luck.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, so long. And everybody, I've got a few more things to let you know about, a few reminders. We do have a wonderful Facebook group where you can discuss these topics further. If you just go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, you'll find it, and you're invited to post comments about today's dialogue, or also if you have suggestions or questions for Thursday's dialogue with Andrew Cohen, those are welcome. I'll be speaking with him at 5 p.m. Pacific time on the practice of evolution. We'll be digging into what it takes to live our lives for the sake of the larger evolutionary process. Questions like, how can sincere practice help transform our lives so that they become a reflection of a greater care for the evolutionary process itself? And how do we develop the kind of profound intention this requires? Finally, if anybody you know might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if you want to learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And finally, I want to thank some of the partners and sponsors who've made this all possible, especially the Women of Wisdom Foundation. The Women of Wisdom Foundation is a nonprofit organization led by a circle of wise women. It creates programs to empower women voices and the divine feminine within all. You can join them for their 19th annual Woman of Wisdom Conference, February 17th through 21st, 2011, in Seattle, Washington. The theme will be Women Arise, Unveil the Power of the Divine Feminine. This weekend will include many experiential events, including presenters Susan Weed and Carolyn Sutherland. Visit womenofwisdom.org. And also by our dear friends at Integral Enlightenment. Integral Enlightenment is an authentic contemporary approach to our spiritual practice designed to bring about a total transformation of our humanity. Founded by evolutionary pioneer Craig Hamilton, Integral Enlightenment seeks to revitalize the spiritual path to meet the evolutionary needs of humanity in the 21st century. Integral Enlightenment is a path for those of us who know deep down that spiritual life is about much more than our personal happiness or contentment. It's for those of us who feel compelled to transform ourselves in order to serve the greatest calling there is, the further evolution of life, humanity, and consciousness itself. To find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton and Integral Enlightenment, please visit integralenlightenment.com. So you're welcome to join our Facebook group. You can check our blog. We are hoping to get up our new social networking site soon. You will be receiving an email on Thursday morning with reminders of how to dial in and plug in to our dialogue with Andrew Cohen on Thursday. And so you know, a week from today, I'll be interviewing Claire Zammit on the new feminine power, the amazing awakening of new awareness, passion, and empowerment among contemporary women, something that is of importance and interest not just to women, but also to men. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. Good night.
The moderator has left the conference.